Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of The Chilling. If you joined me before, you've heard tales of monsters among us, spooky specters, and reportedly haunted houses. Today, in light of the recent Netflix documentary, The Night Stalker, we will chronicle the tale of another monster among us in Richard Ramirez. As I said during the first Monsters Among Us episode on Ed Gein, I do not put serial killers on any sort of a pedestal. These horrific beings take innocent lives, wreck families, and in some cases bodies of the deceased have never been found. The details of this case may be disturbing to some members of the audience. And honestly, the details of rapes and sexual assaults are disturbing to me. I have a hard time talking about it and sharing it, so please keep that in mind. I'm not celebrating this person. Obviously, listener discretion is advised. Ricardo Leyva Munoz Ramirez was born February 29th in 1960 in El Paso, Texas. If you watch the Netflix documentary, you'll see pictures of a normal-looking and kind of cute little kid. He's precocious and chubby-cheeked, bright-eyed, innocent, and adorable. Unfortunately, he would be warped and fashioned into an instrument of destruction that created a wave of terror in California that they had not seen, likely since the Manson family, or very recently, to when Richard Ramirez took place, the Hillside Strangler. In every case of a serial killer, by definition, a person who commits a series of murders, often with no apparent motive and typically following characteristic or predictable pattern, and the FBI defines it as two or more killings within a one-year period with a cooling-off period in between. We must look psychologically at whether this was a case of nature, or as in someone who was born with the predilection to murder, or nurture. Events and circumstances created a monster. While I'm no psychologist, and I would hypothesize in the case of Richard Ramirez that it was the result of nurture in a way which no person should endure. Ultimately, a person's actions are a result of their own decisions, and I'll make no excuse for Richard. I do think, however, that if circumstances were different, he would have been a completely different person. This episode will chronicle the life, the times, and the horrible crimes of Richard Ramirez. Richard Ramirez was one of five children of his father Julian and his mother Mercedes. Julian was a Juarez policeman in Mexico. However, moving to El Paso meant that he had to work as a laborer for the Santa Fe Railway. Julian was a man of an intemperate disposition and was prone to fits of outrage that often resulted in physical abuse of his children. Between the ages of 10 and 12, whether it was due to parental abuse or the negative influences of his cousin Mike, things started to really go off the rails for Richard. He began smoking weed at the age of 10, which I don't even know if I was aware of weed at 10 years old. Also, to escape the wrath of his father, Richard would oftentimes sleep in a nearby cemetery. The influence of his cousin Mike, however, was more likely the flashpoint that created the monster that Richard would become in his later years. Miguel Mike Ramirez was a decorated Green Beret combat veteran of Vietnam. If that were the only case, he likely would have been a great influence on young Richard. Unfortunately, Mike plied the young Richard with photos of victims of his war crimes, including photos of women he'd raped and photos of himself posing with a severed head of a woman he had killed. Mike shared joints and war stories with young Richard, in addition to teaching him military skills such as using stealth to stalk a victim.
In May of 1973, Mike fatally shot his wife in the face after a domestic argument while Richard was present. Richard reportedly became sullen and withdrawn after his cousin was arrested and sent to serve a prison sentence. His parents sent him off to live with his older sister Ruth and her husband Roberto. Roberto was unfortunately a peeping Tom, and he took Richard out on his night patrols with him to look through the windows of unsuspecting neighbors. During this time, Richard was also reportedly started to show an interest in Satanism and began using LSD. At this point, I want to take a quick aside to point out that the Satanism that Richard practiced was vastly different than what the Church of Satan preaches based on my research. Richard had a fundamental misunderstanding that is not too uncommon. Satanism in actual practice is meant as a dark, heavy-handed mockery of Christianity in opposition to worshiping an actual devil. Richard obviously took it too seriously to heart, not unlike a person that trains to be a Jedi in their mom's basement. In 1977, Mike, his cousin, was released from prison after being incarcerated for 4 years, as he was found not guilty by reason of insanity for the crime of killing his wife. He continued to have an influence over Richard's life. This continued medley of sex and violence led an adolescent Richard to begin to have violent sexual fantasies like that of bondage and rape. While still in school, Richard took a job at a local Holiday Inn. At this job, Richard took the opportunity to rob guests, and eventually, he tried to live out his sexual fantasies by assaulting a female guest at the hotel. Fortunately, the woman's husband intervened the attempted assault and proceeded to beat the absolute shit out of Richard. This could have been the end of Richard's reign of terror, or at least put a temporary pause in it. But it was not to be. The couple, although obviously disturbed, would not return to El Paso to testify against Richard, and ultimately the charges were dropped. Not to do any kind of what's termed as victim blaming, but I wish they'd testified. It would be the first in a series of near misses that could have stopped Richard right in his tracks. He wasn't a smart criminal, but he was extremely lucky, as we'll see throughout this story. Richard was not a smart man in general. He dropped out of high school in the 9th grade, so it's likely he could not have gotten gainful employment outside of his hotel job. Somehow, he struck out for California at the age of 22 in 1982. Adult Richard was an interesting-looking guy. Some people have described him as, quote-unquote, good-looking. He was thin and 6'1", which is tall as someone like me, but his face was drawn, his eyes appeared as if lifeless, his teeth became a telltale sign that the same intruder was committing these crimes, because his teeth were disgusting. Richard lived on a diet of soda and candy. His teeth bore that out as they were a rotten, smelly, disgusting mess. He loved to wear black clothing like his members only jacket and a black AC/DC cap. His stench was reportedly ungodly and likened to that of a homeless person. So it's reasonable to assume his personal hygiene was unfortunately the pits. California, and especially Los Angeles in the 1980s, was a very populous area, but had not yet outgained New York in population. You get the sense from the documentary, once again, called The Night Stalker on Netflix, that even with the recent wave of crime of the Hillside Strangler, people still had a Midwestern mentality in their early 80s California. Doors were left unlocked, and there wasn't much thought to someone intruding into a person's home. Richard Ramirez would use this naivety and well-intentioned lack of cynicism to his advantage in living out his fantasies and committing thefts along the way. The first known murder committed by Richard Ramirez was actually not tied to him until 2009. The use of DNA tied him to the rape and murder of a 9-year-old Chinese-American girl named Mei Lung. He beat and raped her, stabbed her to death, and hung her body from a pipe. This murder occurred in a hotel in which he was living on April 10th, 1984. There's another man that was believed to be part of this assault. He has not been arrested as of this recording. He followed that up 2 months later on June 28, 1984. Richard stabbed and nearly decapitated 79-year-old Jenny Vincow in her Glassell Park, Los Angeles home. Ramirez left his fingerprints at the scene on a mesh screen he had removed to break into the house. For unapparent reasons, this was not tied to him at the time. On March 17, 1985, Ramirez reportedly followed Maria Hernandez to the Rosemead, California home she shared with her roommate, Dale Okazaki. Richard snuck into the garage as Hernandez pulled in and closed the garage door. From the reports of Hernandez, who survived, Ramirez smacked his hand on the trunk of her roommate's car to get Hernandez's attention. He then shot her in the face with a .22 caliber handgun. Hernandez's life was miraculously saved because the bullet ricocheted off keys that she raised in her hand to cover her face. Believing Hernandez to be dead, Ramirez entered the home. Okazaki, having heard the shot in the garage, hid behind a counter, and Ramirez waited on the other side of it. When Okazaki, raised her head, he shot her once in the head, killing her. He was then surprised to encounter Hernandez again as he intended to make his escape. She said something to the effect that he should go ahead and get it over with, but Ramirez, being the coward he was, left without any further confrontation. Less than an hour after the shooting of Maria Hernandez and the murder of Dale Okazaki, Ramirez struck again. He pulled Sia Lian Yu, I'm not good with these names, out of her car in Monterey Park. He shot her twice and fled. She died at the scene. While methodical or organized killers like BTK would take their time to research their victims and set up a hit kit of sorts, Ramirez was an unorganized killer, which in some ways seems all the more terrifying, as he could hit anywhere at any time. The coverage of all three attacks in one night was all over the news, yet Ramirez was not yet dubbed the Night Stalker. 10 days later, Ramirez revisited the scene of a home he had previously burglarized outside of Whittier, California. He shot and killed Vincent Zazzara while he slept. Zazzara's wife, Maxine, woke to the sound of the report of the gunshot. Ramirez beat her and tied her hands, demanding to know where their valuables were kept. Ramirez turned the house over while looking for valuables. As he was doing this, Maria was able to escape her bonds and grab a shotgun that Zazzara had stashed under the bed. She pointed at Ramirez and pulled the trigger to find the shotgun was not loaded. This being yet another example of a moment that could have gone another way and ended Ramirez's reign of terror. Ramirez was angered that she had tried to shoot him and was somehow more violent than he had been before. He shot poor Maria 3 times with his .22, then grabbed a carving knife to remove her eyes post-mortem. He put them in the jewelry box and fled the home. The Zazzara home was where the first evidence against Richard Ramirez was recovered. A footprint from an Avia shoe. The shoe was the only one of its kind sold in California and would be used to link Ramirez to a number of Night Stalker killings and attacks for some time. At this point, it's worth noting that the shoe print would also be used to tie Richard Ramirez to a string of child abductions in which he would kidnap male or female children, rape them, and then let them go free. It's just another disgusting, twisted act from a disgustingly twisted man. May 14th, 1985, Ramirez enters the Monterey Park home of Bill and Lillian Doy. Ramirez, true to form, shoots Bill in the head. One thing a person may not know about a .22 caliber bullet is that it is very small. It's a small caliber weapon. Don't get me wrong, it can still kill a person, but oftentimes a .22 caliber bullet will bounce off of hard tissues like bone. It can take a long time to die from the wound from a .22, such was the case with Bill Doy, who was able to pull his own handgun after being shot in the head. Ramirez was likely startled, however. He beat Doy into unconsciousness. Ramirez then bound the disabled Lillian and raped her. Bill Doy would later die due to his injuries. 15 days later, Ramirez entered the home of octogenarian sisters Mabel Bell and Floris Lang. Using a hammer he found in the kitchen, he bludgeoned and bound Lang in her room, and then bludgeoned Bell before using an electrical cord to shock her. He then raped Lang and used lipstick to draw a pentagram on her thigh and some on the walls in the home. The women were found 2 days later, and Bell would succumb to her injuries and pass away. The next day in Burbank, Ramirez entered the home of Carol Kyle. He bound Kyle and her 11-year-old son at gunpoint. He released Kyle so they could direct him to the valuables in the home, and then raped her. He instructed her not to look at him and threatened to cut out her eyes. He bound the two together and left the scene of the crime. July 5th, 1985. Ramirez enters the home in Sierra Madre and bludgeoned 16-year-old Whitney Bennett with a tire iron while she slept. He then attempted to strangle the girl with a telephone cord. Something he did caused there to be an electrical spark. Ramirez, fearing the spark was a sign from Jesus Christ, fled the home. Bennett miraculously survived her beating, even though she needed 478 stitches in her scalp. 2 days later, Ramirez entered the Monterey Park home of Joyce Nelson, a single woman in her 60s. Ramirez found her sleeping on her couch. He attempted to rape her, but according to reports and testimony from her family in the documentary, she fought him off. He was not able to sexually assault her, and this angered Richard. He violently beat her with his fist and stomped her head so hard he left a shoe print from his Avia sneaker on her face. Later that same day, a still keyed up Richard Ramirez returned to the Monterey Park neighborhood and entered the home of 60-year-old Sophie Dickman. Ramirez beat her, bonded her, and attempted to rape her. He then stole her jewelry and asked if there was anything left in the home. When she swore it was all that she had, he told her to swear to Satan. July 20th, 1985, Ramirez, armed with a machete, entered the Glendale, California home of Layla and Maxon Needing. After entering their bedroom, Ramirez hacked them with a machete prior to killing them with shots from the .22 to the head. He mutilated them further post-mortem, stole their valuables, and left the home. Later that evening, he entered the home of the Covanth family. He shot the sleeping Chainarong in the head with a .25 caliber handgun before repeatedly raping his wife, Somkid. He bound their 8-year-old son and then dragged Somkid around the house to point out valuables. He once again demanded that his victim swear to Satan. August 6, 1985, Ramirez broke into the Northridge home of Chris and Virginia Peterson. Breaking from his normal M.O., Ramirez shot Virginia in the face with a .25 caliber handgun. He then shot her husband in the neck and attempted to flee. A struggle ensued, and Chris avoided two more shots before Ramirez fled the scene. Fortunately, the couple survived their injuries. 2 days later, Ramirez drove to Diamond Bar, California, and entered the home of Sakina and Elias Abuath. He killed the husband Elias with a .25 caliber shot to the head. He then handcuffed, beat, and raped Sakina before dragging her through the home looking for valuables. He once again requested that his victim swear to Satan that she was not hiding anything from him. On August 18, 1985, Ramirez assaulted Peter and Barbara Pan in their home, shooting and killing both and sexually assaulting the wife Barbara. At the scene, Ramirez once again used lipstick to draw pentagrams and to also write Jack the Knife on the walls of the home. As Ramirez's initial crimes took place in Los Angeles, the local PD had kept a tight wraps on the ballistics information for the handguns, and they placed a high priority on keeping knowledge of the Avia shoe footprint, confidential. In most of investigations, it's important for the authorities to have some information close to the vest so they can confirm the story, whether it be they catch their guy or to weed out the psychos that make false confessions to crimes they didn't commit. Unfortunately, San Francisco Mayor Dianne Feinstein gained knowledge of the Avia shoe print and released that information in a press conference. In another lucky break, Ramirez had been watching the coverage and reportedly dropped his shoes off the Golden Gate Bridge. Another near miss would follow on August 24, 1985, after Ramirez broke into the Mission Viejo home of James Romero. Romero's son happened to be awake and heard Ramirez attempting to break in. He woke his father, who noted the color, make, model, style of car, and partial license plate of the stolen car that Ramirez had been driving. Ramirez then entered the home of Bill Carnes and his fiancée Inez Erickson. Ramirez shot Carnes 3 times in the head. He then referred to himself as the Night Stalker to Erickson and demanded she swear she loved Satan as he beat and bound her. He stole cash, jewelry, and raped Erickson before leaving the home. Erickson ran to a neighbor's home to get help for her wounded fiancé. Doctors removed 2 of the bullets from Carnes, and he actually survived the attack. Erickson gave a detailed description of her attacker to the police. They were able to gain a single fingerprint from the stolen car. When they cross-referenced that fingerprint in the database, they identified Ramirez from when he had previously been arrested for several petty crimes in El Paso, Texas. They now had the identity and a booking photo for the sentient piece of shit known as the Night Stalker. Police taunted Ramirez by conducting a press conference in which they said, "We know who you are now, and soon everyone will. There will be nowhere you can hide." And this sets up was arguably my favorite part, absolute favorite part of any true crime story ever. And I'm serious. This is awesome. You know, obviously Ramirez's crimes are terrible, but this, the way that it ended was just so fitting. And I can't wait to share it with y'all. Ramirez was in Arizona visiting his brother when the information was released to the press. So he didn't even know. His booking photo was now on the cover of every major newspaper and television news program in California. Police were stationed at the entrance of the bus terminal. And unfortunately, Ramirez was inbound instead of outbound. So they thought he might try to skip town. And unfortunately, he was actually coming back into town. And he made the undercover police that were dressed like vagrants at the bus station. So he was able to avoid them, but then he entered a convenience store in East Los Angeles because he didn't realize the police were there for him. He just knew that they were police from the way that they looked. So he entered a convenience store in East Los Angeles, and an elderly Mexican woman uttered El Matador, which means the killer, in his presence. This garnered his attention, which was then transfixed on a newspaper on a stand bearing his booking photo. Ramirez fled and ran over the Santa Ana freeway, where he attempted to escape through a neighborhood, hopping fences and attempting carjackings. Ramirez was descended upon by bystanders who had recognized him from the newspapers and television. He was then beaten by a group of residents, including being beaten about the head by a metal pipe. And one man actually told his wife to go get his gun because he was going to execute Richard in the streets. Absolute vigilante justice. I love that this community absolutely beat the shit out of Ramirez until the police arrived to take him into custody. Not to say vigilante justice is right or just, but if anyone ever had it coming, it was Richard Ramirez. Ramirez's trial was an absolute circus, including him raising a hand with a pentagram drawn on it and declaring "Hail Satan" to an open court. He had threatened to shoot the prosecutor, although there is no way of knowing how he intended to get a weapon in the courtroom. Additionally, a juror was found dead in her apartment, which frightened the other jurors until that juror's boyfriend was eventually found dead in a hotel room of suicide from the same weapon. On September 20th, 1989, Ramirez was found guilty on all charges. 13 counts of murder, 5 attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults, and 14 burglaries. He was subsequently sentenced to die in California's gas chamber, to which he replied to reporters, "Big deal. Death always went with the territory. See you in Disneyland." Ramirez was famous and will receive nude photos and other items from misguided fans during his time on death row. His admirers, as stated in the Netflix documentary, were more likely addicted to fame, despite that it was associated with a rapist, murderous bag of dog shit like Richard Ramirez. The Night Stalker was never eventually executed by the state of California. Due to the extensive amount of appeals available to a defendant in a death penalty case in California, the appeals process lasted up until his death at 53 years old on June 7th, 2013. Ramirez died from complications from B-cell lymphoma, which was unfortunately a better fate than he should have been afforded, in my estimation. This monster preyed upon the innocent, and even those that lived to tell the tale likely never felt safe in their own home again. One has to wonder how close we have come in our own homes to falling victim to a prowler or a home invader. Would all the guns and security systems in the world be enough to keep us safe? Richard Ramirez was a monster among us, but it's possible there are others that walk among us to this very day. Until next time, trust the goosebumps on your flesh, the chill on your spine, the uneasy feeling in the pit of your stomach, and the hairs on the back of your neck. It's entirely possible you are about to experience the chilling. It's Johnny Podcast. If you like this episode and you want to help me out, share this podcast with your friends. I know it's a little rough and I'm just getting things under control here. only 5 episodes in, but if there's stories that you want to hear or things that you'd like me to cover, hit me up on Facebook. I'm at JD Leffler. And obviously, you can hit me at my email for my other podcast, theturnbucklepost@gmail.com. Let me know if you have a story you'd like to share. I'd love to hear it. And obviously, any support that you can give me, that would be great. Word of mouth, subscriptions, whatever you can do. That will help me grow the chilling and make it into the show that I think that eventually it can be. So thank you all for listening, and take care of yourselves.